Hello, and welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Julia Ahn, and I am joined today by my fellow co-hosts Amanda Yuen and Fabiana Corsi. The United States invaded Afghanistan in 2001, launching the first phase of its global war on terrorism. Now, 20 years later, the U.S. is still there. In February 2020, an agreement was concluded between the U.S. and Taliban, paving the way for significant withdrawal of U.S. troops and laying the groundwork for intra-Afghan negotiations. However, only days after the signing, violence escalated between the Taliban and Afghan government. Today, we will be discussing why a U.S.-Taliban peace deal is needed, why the U.S. negotiated directly with the Taliban rather than the Afghan government, the consequences of failed negotiations, and the future prospects of peace in Afghanistan. Joining us today is Dr. Michael Rubin.
Michael Rubin is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., senior lecturer at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and senior editor of the Middle East Quarterly. Between 2002 and 2004, Rubin worked as a staff advisor for Iran and Iraq in the Office of the Secretary of Defense at the Pentagon, in which capacity he was seconded to Iraq. Rubin has also worked as a lecturer in Iranian history at Yale University and Johns Hopkins University, SAIS, in Washington, D.C.
Hi, Dr. Rubin. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Julia.
We'll get right into it then. So the United States entered Afghanistan in 2001, and that's almost 20 years ago. For our listeners, would you briefly describe the original purpose of the U.S.-led effort in Afghanistan, and why are we still there 20 years later?
Well, originally, the decision to launch Operation Enduring Freedom, the military intervention in Afghanistan, was to unseat the Taliban government, which had provided space for al-Qaeda, and of course, ultimately led to the September 11th terrorist attacks on New York and Washington. The terror training camps were in Afghanistan under Taliban control, the al-Qaeda camps, that is. Now, what the United States subsequently tried to do was build a government, and the goal is to allow the government to control the use of force within its own territory to enable the United States to leave. If the Afghan government is able to assure that that its territory won't be used for al-Qaeda or other terrorists, that's been, for these past 20 years, the goal of U.S. presence.
Could you please explain to our listeners the U.S.-Taliban peace deal of February 2020?
Well, the peace deal, which was released on February 29th, 2020 in Doha, came after months of negotiations between Zameh Khalilzad, who's the U.S. special envoy for these Afghan talks, and Taliban representatives from their political office in Doha, Qatar. And the basic goal was to enable an agreement between the Taliban and the United States to enable the United States to leave and also to further the cause of peace in Afghanistan. The idea behind these talks was that the Taliban would agree that they wouldn't host any terrorist group. In theory, that would mean decoupling themselves from al-Qaeda. And at the same time, would then turn to intra-Afghan. The Taliban would then turn to intra-Afghan dialogue in order to allow a broader peace with the Afghan government and other Afghan factions.
So why did these peace negotiations happen now? What catalyzed them? And I guess, why now? Why 2020?
Well, the cynical explanation is after well over a decade of the U.S.-Afghan war, after so many billions of dollars have been expended, thousands of lives, that the United States was simply exhausted. I mean, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, Colin Powell once, who was at the time Secretary of State, once suggested talking to moderate Taliban, and he was pilloried for that suggestion, although that suggestion seems to have come around again as diplomats have argued that perhaps there are moderate Taliban out there with whom we could deal. It's not a view which I share, but it's the view which was put forward there. Now, what Zameh Khalilzad, who has had decades of interacting with the Taliban in various capacities, has argued that the difference between now and previous years is that the Taliban have become more Afghan nationalists. They want an Afghan solution, whereas in the past, they weren't as interested in that sort of thing. Again, I don't share that view, and many in the Afghan government don't share that view, but that's the view which has been put forward to justify why now within the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain to our listeners some of the commitments of the deal, some of the major points that they should take away when learning about it?
Well, the biggest tripping point right now, and therefore this becomes really the most prominent aspect of the deal, if only because the two sides continue not to agree on it, would be that the Afghan government would release 5,000 prisoners and the Taliban would release 1,000 prisoners. And that would pave the way, that would greenlight the ability to have the beginning of intra-Afghan talks between the Taliban and a peace delegation appointed by the Afghan government. The problem here is no one's been able to really decide on what numbers the prisoners are, whether they're legitimate prisoners or not, and also whether or not those Taliban who are released from prison are going to be allowed to go back and continue to fight for the Taliban. Once these prisoner releases occur, and we're now months overdue on these, we had a very specific timeline agreed for intra-Afghan dialogue. And of course, that deadline has come and went before again. Now, the tricky aspect of this, of course, is it's just a deal between the Taliban and the United States. Therefore, because the elected Afghan government isn't a signatory to this deal, there's also been a lot of questions raised as to, well, you're committing us to do this, but we're not a signatory to this deal. We didn't negotiate it. We didn't agree to it. And so that's also just adding a layer of complexity to actually implementing the understanding that has occurred.
So, Dr. Rubin, in 19 years of dealing with the Taliban in Afghanistan since the September 11th attacks, how is this 2020 deal different in key ways from previous peacemaking strategies that the United States has attempted in Afghanistan?
Well, this is where I'm most critical of the deal, because first of all, I don't see much difference. We have to take Zalmay Khalilzad at his word that the Taliban have changed their attitudes, but nothing in the Taliban behavior or statements leads anyone else besides Zalmay Khalilzad to see that. But I also just want to push back for a second, Fabi, that you've got a situation where we started negotiating with the Taliban long before 9/11. During the Clinton administration, the Taliban had managed to consolidate control over 90% of Afghanistan. And therefore, they actually had a lobbyist, the daughter-in-law of the former CIA director, Richard Helms, a woman named Layli Helms, was the Taliban's lobbyist in Washington, D.C. And what she would go around arguing in the White House, in the State Department, and elsewhere was, you know, the Taliban are no worse than Saudi Arabia, so we should simply recognize them, as opposed to the Northern Alliance, who we had actually recognized to that point, but had only controlled 10% of the country. Now, the deal which the Clinton administration had more or less negotiated in more than 30 meetings with the Taliban, up to and including the foreign minister of the Taliban, back in the late 1990s, was that they would close terror training camps and at the time quarantine Osama bin Laden. Well, the new deal suggests that they will close terror training camps and decouple themselves from Al-Qaeda. So there really is no difference there. I'm a historian, so I get paid to predict the past. And admittedly, I only get that right about half the time. But it's also important to remember that you had intra-Afghan talks before. When the Taliban emerged in 1994, down near Kandahar. They seized the border towns near the Pakistan border. They seized Herat in 1995, but you still had the recognized government of Afghanistan in Kabul. And at the time, there was ongoing intra-Afghan talks, which the United Nations was trying to sponsor. And against the backdrop of these intra-Afghan talks, the Taliban entered Kabul and took over the city. And that created the Taliban government across pretty much all of Afghanistan. Now, what the Afghan government is saying today is, what's changed? You're not requiring that the Taliban lay down their arms against us. You're saying there have to be intra-Afghan talks, but at the same time, hundreds of Afghan soldiers are being killed by the Taliban. So how can we trust them more than we trusted them 25 years ago? And that ultimately is the question that so many critics of the peace deal ask.
So you mentioned in the past that the Afghan government isn't a signatory on the deal, and you talked about how that was making things complicated in implementation. So why did the United States negotiate directly with the Taliban as opposed to with the Afghan government?
Well, first of all, it's not only the Afghan government, which wasn't a participant in these talks. Pakistan, in theory, wasn't, and India wasn't as well. So ultimately, more people were left out of these talks than were brought into these talks. The reason why so many people were left out of the talks is, frankly, if you started taking into account the concerns of regional actors as well as the Afghan government, it would be a lot harder to come to an agreement. There are certain things that were red lines for the Afghan government, for example. So we came to an agreement, but the question is, if you don't do the hard work to bring in the other regional actors who are involved here, is the agreement worth more than the paper it's written on? Now, we tried to get around that by, basically bullying the Afghan government. When we've started denying visas to senior Afghan officials, including the current vice president of Afghanistan, Amrullah Saleh, because we didn't want him talking to Congress and raising difficult questions. We literally blacklisted the Afghan National Security Advisor, Ambassador Mohib, a former ambassador to the United States, so that if he entered a room, all U.S. officials would leave. And the reason was because he publicly criticized the way Zalmay Khalilzad was going around the negotiations. So we do have a really difficult situation right now. Now, the reason why the Trump administration pushed forward with this, I have reason to believe it's because Donald Trump constantly hectored American officials saying we're spending $30 billion per year in Afghanistan. What is Afghanistan to us? Let's get out of here. And so in reality, it's a political decision, and the peace talks have merely been window dressing for that political decision.
So a lot of our listeners might still be remembering how, well, even now, that the Taliban and its links to Al-Qaeda and terrorism. And so a question they might have is, why go against the U.S. policy of not negotiating with terrorist organizations? Is this going against that policy?
Well, number one, there's the big question about what is a terrorist. And I don't mean to be academically cute here, but terrorism in international relations, in political science, in international law, is a lot like pornography in that old Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart quip that I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it. There is no international consensus definition of terrorism. Now, when it comes to the United States, of course, we have the State Department's designation of terrorist groups and state sponsors of terrorism. And after 9/11, you had the Bush administration, President George W. Bush, issue an executive order which allowed the Treasury Department to also designate individuals. And if you actually look and compare the State Department list of terrorist groups with the Treasury Department group, the Treasury Department group is an order of magnitude greater simply because they don't take into account these diplomatic considerations. And therefore, with a sleight of hand, we can ignore the fact that the Taliban, in my opinion, are a terrorist group, and simply say they're an insurgency or they're an armed group. And you see this if you look at the preamble or the title to the February 29th deal. We define the Taliban, I don't have the treaty right in front of me, but an armed group which has been fighting the government of Afghanistan, which is called the Taliban. That's basically how it's addressed. Now, the basic problem here is while the Taliban will say, we have no formal connections with Al-Qaeda, we've got to recognize that on a very personal level, the difference between the Taliban and a member of Al-Qaeda, number one, that could be transitory, whoever's stronger at the time. People move around between groups, but it could be someone's cousin or it could be someone's nephew. And in a tribal culture like Afghanistan, are we getting to the point where we will accept that the Taliban are going to say, we're going to decouple ourselves from Al-Qaeda, when in reality, that means fathers decoupling themselves from sons or cousins decoupling themselves from cousins. And in that situation, frankly, it's not realistic, and it shouldn't surprise that, if anything, the Taliban have even embraced Al-Qaeda more since February 29th than before.
So you talked a little bit about how the Afghan government was not involved in the deal and is kind of getting bullied by the United States. And so what was the reaction of the Afghan government and the Afghanistan public to the plan?
With regard to the Afghan government, there was a great deal of anger, and a lot of this anger is directed towards Zalmay Khalilzad because, look, back in 2001, Zalmay Khalilzad actually wanted to do business with the Taliban when he was working for UNICAL. This is all documented in the Washington Post. But beyond that, you had a frustration that if the United States simply wants to leave Afghanistan, and that's the sense that most Afghans have, why don't they just leave Afghanistan instead of tying our hands with an agreement which simply makes the Afghan government's position more precarious? That's ultimately the situation. With regard to the ordinary Afghan people, they're frustrated with the United States. And frankly, they think they're being sold down the river because they don't believe that the Afghan government necessarily can defeat the Taliban on its own. So they believe they've been set up to fail because we've spent all this time training them and suddenly we're pulling the carpet out from underneath them. That doesn't mean that the Taliban are going to be able to consolidate control over the government either. And so I heard this during my last trip to Afghanistan that last fall. There's just a lot of people who are worried that we're going to go into a new round of civil war, that really, instead of being the beginning of the end, it's the end of the beginning.
So kind of following up on that point of the U.S. just wanting to pull troops out of Afghanistan with or without a deal, why is it important that we make a peace deal with Afghanistan? And I know you talked a little bit about how the politics of just removing troops from the region is something that's important to President Trump, as well as the American public, some would argue.
Well, I mean, this circles back to the immediate post 9/11 debate about whether the United States can ever be secure if terrorists have a vacuum from which to operate. The question is, if the United States withdraws from Afghanistan, is there anyone who's going to control that territory, who's going to be responsible for that territory? Would we simply be looking at a failed state in Afghanistan, which perhaps we could live with, or would groups like Al-Qaeda or increasingly the Islamic State take root in Afghanistan and for ideological reasons pursue attacks against the United States elsewhere? Despite us being in Afghanistan for almost two decades, I've heard some military practitioners argue, you know, we can't call this a failure because we haven't suffered another 9/11. And that's because we have denied the territory to Al-Qaeda, that they can't operate with impunity. We may or may not accept that line of argument. But the question is, would we be safer if the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda were able to consolidate control in Afghanistan? Would the Taliban even be able to prevent them from doing so if the Taliban wanted to act in good faith? And if the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda were able to sink their roots in Afghanistan, what would it mean to the United States? And we could debate that. And what would it mean for regional countries like India or Pakistan or Iran or the former Soviet Union?
So could you talk a little bit about how the prioritization of withdrawing troops from Afghanistan factors into the peace negotiations, both from maybe a political perspective as well as like a public relations perspective, if you will?
Well, it's a great question. And this is one of the discussions which we've been having with the Afghans and with the Taliban. One of the reasons why the February 29th agreement hasn't been the end all and be all. First of all, there's the question about whether all U.S. forces need to leave before the talks really get going. And if the talks are delayed as they have been, whether the United States withdrawal should continue apace. That's question number one here. The other issue is, and this was kicked down the road by Special Envoy Khalilzad, is whether the United States is going to be allowed to have a residual intelligence presence in order to monitor or even conduct counterterrorism operations. And on one hand, the Afghan government may want that to occur. But on the other hand, the Taliban might say and have said, you know, this needs to be on the table and we can't guarantee that there will be any Americans left. By the way, another aspect to this, and this is something I hear in Afghanistan going back to the previous question, is while the Taliban will say, we want no foreign forces to remain in Afghanistan, we're Afghan nationalists, a lot of people in the Afghan government would say, well then, what are you going to do with the Chechens who are fighting with you, or the Uyghurs who are fighting with you, or the Arabs who are fighting with you, or the Pakistanis who are fighting with you? Why don't you tell these jihadists to go home and that they need to go home first? And again, while the Afghan government will argue this point, it's not something which was directly addressed within the peace agreement.
So, Dr. Rubin, we've been reading a lot about this plan and, you know, many people are very critical of it, and many have even written that the plan was destined to fail from the very beginning. Would you agree with that stance?
I would agree with that stance. And the natural question to follow up with, and I've been asked this during debates and in policy discussions more privately with officials, well, if we don't want to conduct endless war, then what other choice do we have? And Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, right when she entered office, I guess in 2009 said, if you're not going to negotiate with your enemies, then who are you going to negotiate with? And on one hand, she's right. But on the other hand, there's two problems here. You got to negotiate from a position of leverage. So what have we done to increase our leverage? And the second issue is, are the Taliban really the people to negotiate with, or are a lot of the broader shots being called by Pakistan? After all, the Taliban leadership resides in Pakistan. Many of them haven't stepped foot in Afghanistan for 20 years. And a lot of, 90%, according to the Afghan National Security Council, 90% of the precursor chemicals that are used in explosives and improvised explosive devices used by the Taliban in Afghanistan come from one of two Pakistani fertilizer plants, and Pakistan could easily shut those down or monitor the exports, but they choose not to. So the question is, what pressure could we assert on Pakistan in order to get them to cut themselves off from the Taliban? And there are a lot of different strategies we could have done here. For example, in the wake of 9/11, when we ramped up things in Afghanistan, I believe it was the Bush administration had declared Pakistan a major non-NATO ally. Well, that comes with a lot of financial goodies, if it were, and we could simply undesignate them as such. Pakistan remains on the Financial Action Task Force gray list, when in reality, they deserve to be on the blacklist for the financing of various terrorist groups. They haven't been put on the blacklist largely because of diplomatic pressure. We should end that. They should be on the blacklist. We should basically gauge our policy or calibrate our policy to what Pakistan is rather than what it should be. And then rather than simply try to bribe Pakistan with more aid, we should try the other tact and tell Pakistan, we're going to give these various technologies to India unless you start reigning in the Taliban. Until we get Pakistan under control, I'm not sure there can be any progress with the Taliban. The analogy I would make is negotiating with the Taliban without considering Pakistan would be like negotiating with Hezbollah in Lebanon without considering Iran.
So given these different strategies that we can try moving forward, and of course, given that there were issues and, you know, deeply incorporated within this plan from the very beginning, are there any ways in which the plan was a success, and are there any smaller victories that we can build on here, or was there just nothing that we can really use moving forward?
at this point, I think the greatest handicap to United States moving forward is the lack of U.S. political will. I mean, let's be realistic. The United States is undergoing an almost unprecedented financial shock. And if you ask the ordinary American, they're not going to understand why we need to be spending $30 billion a year in Afghanistan, or perhaps even more than that, if we want to drive the Taliban backwards. One of the other criticisms here, of course, of why perhaps this isn't working would be, what are we doing to bring in India? I mean, the Indians have been frustrated because Zalmay Khalilzad hasn't fully, I mean, he avoided reading them into a lot of negotiations, all the while talking about why they were an important state that would have to be play a role in guaranteeing the agreement. The Indians could do a lot to fill the vacuum so that we can get out of there. And unfortunately, the Indians both don't have a great deal of will there. And also, we've done nothing to encourage it. So I've avoided your question a little bit only because I forgot it in my word vomit as I've been answering it. So if you want to answer it again, I'll address it succinctly and get right to the point.
Nope. I definitely think that you mostly answered it. It's just, I think you're getting at the idea that there weren't many successes with this plan. There's just no ways to move forward with what we have now as of this, you know, the results of this attempt at peacemaking.
Yeah, Fabi, I think you're exactly right. And I would actually put it in the same category as the Trump administration's negotiations with North Korea. There might be will at the top, but diplomacy is a very complicated process. It takes lots of groundwork to get things right, and no one has done the groundwork. And when you try to cut corners, diplomacy tends not to succeed. At the same time, as Osama bin Laden once said, in the region, everyone admires the strong horse. No one wants to attach themselves to the weak horse. And therefore, if we are signaling that we want to get out of there as soon as possible, regardless of the outcome of intra-Afghan dialogue, then why would anyone want to ally with themselves if it's an invitation to, from their view, suicide?
So with respect to failed negotiations in the same vein, what might failed negotiations look like in the region in the future, and how could failed negotiations undermine U.S. interests in Afghanistan?
Well, when the short answer to that is it would be a reversion to the Civil War period, which we saw between 1992 and really 2004 when the Taliban emerged, if not 9/11. So you have that civil war period where you have different groups, different warlords controlling different parts of society. The issue then becomes, and this was certainly the case during the civil war period, the question of proxy war. Some groups were supported by the United States, some by Pakistan, some by Iran. And could these proxy wars turn hot? They almost did back in 1999 when Pakistan and Iran almost went to war. You also had tensions back in the year 2000. I guess it was around December 25th, actually, 1999, when an Indian Airlines flight was hijacked and ended up in Taliban-controlled territory. And that led to some serious tension between India and Pakistan, which, of course, are nuclear powers. So you have that question of proxy wars. You have the question of ungoverned spaces being used by terrorist groups. And then you also have the human tragedy. What happens to a generation of women who have been educated? We know how the Taliban treated women. And is that going to be, are we going to have another situation like that? Could we have the fracturing of Afghanistan? If you look at the intra-Afghan dialogue, Afghanistan today is an Islamic republic, meaning it's Islamic, its constitution is tied to Islam, but it elects its president. What the Taliban want is an Islamic emirate where the leader is chosen by a council of religious elders who are appointed by the Taliban. If that can't be resolved, are you going to have a situation of one country, two systems? And ultimately, would that lead to the decline to the collapse of Afghanistan.
So one of the things that we wanted to talk about in the podcast was the recent allegations of the recent New York Times report about Taliban soldiers hired to kill U.S. troops by Russian intelligence units. How do you think this news will impact future efforts towards a peace deal with the Taliban?
Well, one thing we need to recognize when it comes to Afghanistan is we're not alone in the sandbox. And while a lot of countries don't want the Taliban to succeed, they don't want the United States to succeed either. Their ideal outcome would be for the United States and the Taliban to continue to bloody themselves. We had not only the Russians, for example, allegedly providing bounties to kill American soldiers, but we also had the Iranians arming the Taliban with pretty definitive proof emerging from time to time on this. We need to recognize that we are really in a fight for the post-World War II liberal order. It's not just all about Afghanistan. And we need to also keep in mind, we can't be naive about diplomacy. Some people look at diplomacy as how to get to yes, how to come to a solution. Other countries or other groups will look at diplomacy as an asymmetric warfare strategy in order to tie the hands of the United States while they try to achieve their aims in other ways.
Could you talk a little bit about like maybe your ideas or what do you, obviously it's hard to predict the future, but your ideas for what, how a peace plan can work in the future if a peace plan is possible based on, I guess, U.S. political interests as well as the current state of negotiations?
Well, I think a peace plan can work in the future if the timing is right. The idea of intra-Afghan dialogue makes sense. If the Taliban are Afghan nationalists, let them negotiate inside Afghanistan. Let's have the Taliban return their leadership from Pakistan to Afghanistan. And if the Taliban are cut off from their sponsors from Pakistan, maybe they would have some incentive. I would even argue that the Taliban, if they are as popular as they claim to be, should submit themselves to international elections, I mean, to monitored elections. But if the Taliban only can win 3% of the support of Afghans, that should also be, that should also signal that perhaps we shouldn't turn over the leadership of the country to Afghanistan, that it would be a fundamental betrayal to the Afghan people.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Rubin, for coming on our podcast. That was all the questions we had for you today.
Okay, thank you.
Don't forget to rate us 5 stars and leave us a review wherever you're listening to this podcast. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at HopkinsPOFA. That's at Hopkins, P-O-F-A, where we share updates and articles that expand on podcast topics and international affairs. Thanks for listening.